sky. Take away everything and make everybody feel high. But if you know what life is worth, you would look for yours unhurt. And now you see the light, you stand up for your rights. Yeah.
Get up, stand up.
Yeah, yeah.
Stand up for your rights.
Ism, schism, game, dine and go to heaven in the Jesus' name, Lord. We know and we understand. Almighty God is a living man. You can fool some people sometimes, but you can't fool all the people all the time. So now we see the light.
What you gonna
we gonna stand up for
yeah,
our rights.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
You better get
up, stand up
in the morning.
Don't give it up.
Stand up for your rights.
Stand up.
This is Maseroth on KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. KBOO's Board of Directors meets on the fourth Monday of the month at 6 p.m. This month's meeting will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland and online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting virtually can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
Join KBOO around the campfire. Become a member during Camp KBOO's Summer Drive, taking place now through June 29th. Your contribution goes towards grassroots community radio. Donate now by going to kboo.fm/give. Thank you.
Welcome to Sprouts, Radio from the Grassroots, a weekly program that showcases radio production by independent community media. We bring local stories to a global audience, produced at a different location every week.
In much of the central part of Amazonia, the rains will raise the water level 15 feet. I had a hard time getting accustomed to an image that kept being raised for me by the scientists, which is, see those branches? Part of the year, those branches have fish swimming through them, and part of the year, they have birds sitting on top of them.
I'm Gary Niederhoff, producer of Big Picture Science in Mountain View, California, where we draw surprising connections between the latest science and technology research to give you the big picture. Today on Sprouts, we hear about Amazonia, the biome that covers most of the Amazon basin of South America. We start with special guest Cynthia Gorney, contributing writer at the National Geographic Society, who reports from her most recent expedition in Brazil, where the sheer size of the Amazon River defies belief.
When I look to my right, I know theoretically that I'm looking at a river, but when the mud actually stops and you can see the glimmer of water, it's just water all the way out to the horizon. This is the biggest river on Earth. But it's really hard to remember when you're looking at it that it's a river and not the sea.
And the Amazon isn't simply one river. It's a vast network of thousands of rivers and tributaries and the largest flow of fresh water on Earth. The rainforest is home to the most diverse collection of plant and animal species on the planet, many of which are still undiscovered. The area is also home to millions of people, including indigenous groups that have lived there for millennia and whose participation is key to preserving this vital ecosystem. I'm Molly Bentley, and in this episode, we go to South America to reveal the threat to and the hope for the Amazon. This episode is Amazing Amazonia.
Nine a.m., a little bit hard for me to see through the sweat running down into my eyes, but I'm going to get on the boat for Macapá shortly.
When National Geographic reporter Cynthia Gorney traveled through Brazil for the most recent issue of the magazine, she was no stranger to its humidity or enchanting beauty. As a reporter for the Washington Post for 16 years, who served as its South American bureau chief for two of them, she lived in Buenos Aires, and she traveled extensively in the Amazon for an 8-part series for the Post. Well, when we heard she was returning to the Amazon to travel on the river, we asked if she wouldn't mind recording a few impressions of her journey, and she joins us now to give the highlights of her trip. Thank you for being here.
I'm really happy to be with you today, Molly.
Now, we're going to hear clips of you traveling in various places. Could you just give us an overview of the kind of travels? You had to go from point A to point B to point C. I mean, what did that itinerary look like? I had a feeling you were traveling all over.
Well, to get to where scientists are working in Amazonia, you have to do some pretty creative travel. In my situation, that involved going to a research station in the Peruvian cloud forest, which is, of course, part of Amazonia, even though it may not seem that way, and more time even in parts of Brazil, which generally meant going to cities. In this case, the city of Manaus, the biggest city in Amazonia, and the smaller, less known city of Macapá, near the mouth where it meets the coast, and in particular, a town called Vila Progresso, which means what it sounds like, a progress village, a tiny community on a small island at the mouth of the Amazon River.
I do have to follow up on the idea of a cloud forest. Now, I think we all have a picture of what a cloud forest might look like. What was the Peruvian cloud forest that you visited?
It is mountainous, and it is what it sounds like. There are massive cloud formations that typically, for much of the day, lower onto the treetops, and occasionally will break up so you have blue sky. But most of the time, when walking there, I felt kind of familiar. I felt as though I was walking on high trails of the mountain in coastal fog. Of course, you're a long way from the coast when you're in the mountains of Peru.
You know, I think that we are all aware that the Amazon is in trouble due to deforestation and climate change, but I get the sense that while we may have an appreciation of what we have to lose, we can't really take it in if we haven't been there.
It was hard for me to take it in, and I was there. The clip you played at the beginning, my amazement at the size of the water, was only a part of it. When you're flying over it, trying to get to one of these either regional or much smaller airports, the size of what's beneath you is staggering. It's we're looking at an area that is the size roughly of the continental United States. I think the part that hits, at least that hit me most, was the enormity of the water. Because in any of the particular locales that you find yourself in, you're looking around and you may say, this is amazing, I've never seen a place quite like this, but it's a locale. You can put your head around its dimensions. It's not until you read the stats and look at the enormity of that water horizon in front of you, that it starts to sink in just how complex and vast this place is.
Well, you mentioned water, and one thing that is clear from my understanding of your reporting is that if you're going to study the Amazon, you have to figure out how to get around it, and that means preparing to travel by river. And in fact, much of this episode, at least, is at river level, but those rivers are key for transportation, aren't they?
The river system, to an extent that I had not appreciated even in my previous travels there, is the highway system for much of Amazonia. There are roads, for sure. And of course, there are big cities, and the big cities have roads and bus systems and taxis and all of that. But in between, the main form of transport for all but the mountain regions is by boat. I'm sitting near the end of a long dock that goes out into what I know is the Amazon River, except that what I'm looking at is a giant flat of dark brown mud. I'm not talking about like muddy water. This is mud thick enough to stand up on. They've told me that the guys here sometimes play soccer on this mud. And this is the mud of low tide. To my left is a three-decker Amazon boat, the kind that delivers people and goods to the islands and small communities up and down the river. And the first time I saw one of these boats when I got to Macapá, I couldn't imagine how it could possibly ever move because it was clearly completely mudbound, like it had been hauled on by chains or a truck or something. And I asked people who were nearby, is that boat stuck? How is it going to take off? And they laughed and said, come back tonight. And when I came back at night, the boat was full of people preparing to leave, and the tide had risen, I don't know, 15 or 20 feet, and the boat now was floating.
Cynthia, where on the river were you where the tides were 15 feet? And those aren't river tides, right? Because rivers don't have tides. I mean, so you must have been close to the Atlantic?
Well, there's a couple of things about that, Molly. First of all, we were somewhat close to the Atlantic in the sense that this was the city, really, of Macapá. It's more than a million people when you get out into the outer regions of the town. Macapá is very much on the river, and the word tides doesn't have quite the same meaning that you and I think, because the river does rise and fall by 15 feet in certain parts of Amazonia. The tides that are coming into Macapá are coming in from the sea, but they're also the river tides.
The tides are different than seasonal flooding, right? The seasonal flooding actually puts part of the rainforest underwater. What is the difference?
The difference really is rain, right? In a normal year, which, let us be clear, Amazonia has not had for the last couple of years, which is important. In a normal year, in much of the central part of Amazonia, the rains, which go on for months, are so profound that they will raise the water level 15 feet, depths that would be catastrophic if they were in most parts of the world. But because that is expected, the houses are built to accommodate it. People plan their travel and their departures from their homes based on the rise and fall of that water. I had a hard time getting accustomed to an image that kept being raised for me by the scientists, which is, see those branches? Part of the year, those branches have fish swimming through them, and part of the year, they have birds sitting on top of them.
Well, you continued your journey on the water from Villa Progresso, which was on the archipelago, to Macapá, and you're about to get into a boat. You're going to be on it for a long time. What does one do to prepare to get on a boat and travel on the Amazon?
Bear in mind that very long journeys like this on the water are a fact of life in this part of the world. And you don't know, as everybody understands, exactly how long the journey is going to be. The river may hang you up. There may be a sudden rain pour. The mud under the river may just stop your boat for a couple of hours at a time. So people are not on a close timetable at all. And a journey of some hours may turn out to be some hours longer than that. And everybody gets that. Sounds like the big engine of the boat. Tide is rising. Last four guys are getting in.
Hammocks are set. Bananas have been brought on board. We're pushing off. A warm breeze is blowing across the river. The tide has come way up. And the deck where my tiny cabin is now full of nets. And one of the styrofoam containers just got opened up, and it's full of shrimp. Shrimp in ice that is somehow supposed to keep these shrimp cold for the next, I think, 10 hours.
Cynthia, did it keep the shrimp cold for 10 hours? And 10 hours, when you said a few hours, I was thinking a couple hours. That's a long time
to
be on
a
boat.
You recall me saying that you can't predict how long these boats are going to be. In fact, it was more like 12 hours.
Oh,
and they
goodness.
Took an hour and a half to kind of get going. So it was a very long trip.
Part of this overwhelming complexity of Amazonia is that it includes these modern cities, but it also includes tiny towns like the one you visited, Villa Progresso. Let's listen.
What's right around me is a small mercantile store. One solar panel. Solar panels are the way that people have at least a little bit of light when the electricity goes out for hours or days, or in some cases, weeks at a time here. People walking quietly back and forth. It's really dark except for the few lights over the houses, and it's really hot and it's really steamy.
And Cynthia, that metallic sound in the background, those are insects?
It's insects.
Those are insects. Okay. Not like insects I've ever heard, but
no, but let's remember one of the other stats about Amazonia is that it has 1/10 of all the insect and animal life on the planet. I can't give you a good insect stat, but I know that there are 10,000 different species of beetle, just beetles, that have been found in Amazonia.
You're listening to Sprouts, Radio from the Grassroots, a weekly program bringing you local radio productions of global interest. I'm Gary Niederhoff, producer of Big Picture Science in Mountain View, California. And this week, we're talking about the incredibly diverse ecosystem of the Amazon Basin and how the area is traversed by native inhabitants as well as visiting explorers.
My name is Larry Roeder. I'm a journalist who has been covering the Amazon since 1978, first for Newsweek magazine, then for the New York Times, and I'm the author of the biography Into the Amazon, The Life of Cândido Rondon. Cândido Rondon was the greatest explorer of the Amazon, and he was a native of the Amazon and of indigenous descent and became a wonderful scientist as well.
The subtitle of Larry Roeder's book about Cândido Rondon is Trailblazing Explorer, Scientist, Statesman, and Conservationist. Born in the mid-19th century, he studied math and astronomy before he undertook a trajectory that made him the Lewis and Clark of Brazil, which is impressive. National Geographic reporter Cynthia Gorney continues to provide perspective for us about the Amazon. Cynthia, why is Cândido Rondon an important figure as we consider the past and future of Amazonia?
Cândido Rondon is an astonishing figure, but his name is really not known, I don't think, certainly not in the U.S. And the number of circles that his life touches in Brazil and the trajectory that he makes, the influence he has, and the way he sets a certain model, which, of course, was not exclusively followed, unfortunately, at all, but remains an important part of the way the indigenous people can and should be treated in Brazil, which is to say with respect for their own way of life, their own culture.
Cândido Rondon grew up in grinding poverty. His father died before he was born, and his mother died of smallpox when he was 2. His mixed ethnic heritage, including that of indigenous descent, would prove an asset when he took an assignment to help connect Brazil with the rest of the world by stringing a telegraph line. At the time, much of Brazil was wild, unmapped, and unknown to the outside world.
At the time Rondon was working, we're talking about 1890 to 1930, there were no established highways or even pathways. He was opening the jungle without trying to destroy it. a pathway that his men could then follow. But once you got out of that cleared area, or when you were moving into new territory, you were constantly on the lookout for these challenges and dangers, whether they be disease, from beriberi to malaria, whether they be wild animals, from very tiny scorpions to large boa constrictors. You just never could let your guard down. And men signed on with Rondon for a sense of adventure, but knowing that they faced these life-ending threats.
Okay, well, this is the environment in which the 1914 Roosevelt expedition unfolds. In 1914, Rondon led a joint American-Brazil expedition up a mysterious river that Candon himself had discovered. It was one that was a tributary of the Amazon River.
Right.
That was thought to be as long as 1,000 kilometers, and he had named it the River of Doubt.
Because he didn't know where it really started or where it would end. And that was in 1909. He said, I got to come back here. And the opportunity came with Roosevelt in December of 1913 all the way through to April of 1914.
So he brings on this expedition the ex-president at that time, right. Theodore Roosevelt.
And two naturalists from the American Museum of Natural History.
Okay. And I think Roosevelt's son.
And Roosevelt's son, Kermit. Yeah.
Kermit. Before we talk about what happened, can you give us a sense, Larry, of how much of the Amazon River had been mapped in 1914?
The main river had been mapped, as had some of the principal tributaries, the Madeira and the Rio Negro among them. Now, the River of Doubt, it was discovered, flowed into the Madeira. So the River of Doubt turns out to be the largest tributary of the largest tributary of the Amazon. And they thought it was going to be 1,000 kilometers long. It's actually 1,400, 1,500 kilometers long.
Okay, this is going to be a challenge for you because we want to summarize a 5-month trip that had a lot of drama in it.
Yeah.
But it is challenging because this was a 5-month trip with lots of peril, real disaster, death in some cases, some near calamities. Can you give us an overview of what this trip required and why Candon was an invaluable leader of this trip?
Yeah, it required above all stamina and cooperation. You know, Rondon and Roosevelt worked together pretty well, considering the pressures they were under. First couple of months are overland. Then they get, at the end of February 1914, to the source of the River of Doubt, and then they begin their descent.
And that was not trivial. They went over 400 miles of land through the jungle.
Oh, more than that.
Okay,
yeah.
More than that. Yeah. So it's not like you're just dropped at mouth of the river.
Uh-uh. You got to get there.
Right, you have to get there. And
that
was
some
perilous.
Of that is unexplored land as well.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get to the river, and then the real hard stuff begins. And there were 22 men. And four of them were Americans, 18 Brazilians. And it took them exactly 2 months to descend the river. They ran out of food. They got sick, malaria and other things. Just incredibly harsh terrain where there's these waterfalls and...
waterfalls, like a series of rapids.
Oh, for weeks on end. And you would have to then portage up onto the land and then haul your canoes. Originally, there were seven. Some got destroyed in rapids. Others broke open when you're lowering them from up above back onto the river.
And when you say you have to portage, it was really Rondon and his men that were doing the portaging, was it not?
Yeah.
And Roosevelt and his men were coming along, but it was
right. The
Brazilians were the ones that understood the jungle, and they understood.
They had the local knowledge.
They had the local knowledge.
Right. They may not have been able to read, but they knew how to read the weather. They knew how to read tracks. They just had this encyclopedic knowledge of the Amazon and the interior of the country.
Can we give one precise example, which is that I believe that Rondon's men and Rondon himself were surprised that the Americans wanted to bring their canoes. I mean, never mind that they were bringing just crates and crates of food and wine and all of this other stuff that was not necessary for the expedition.
Yeah.
But they wanted to bring canoes, whereas the Brazilians thought, no, you just make the canoes as you go along.
Right.
How long does it take to build a canoe in the jungle? Or how long did it take 100 years ago to build a canoe?
Well, with
on
these
the spot,
guys.
On the spot in the jungle.
Yeah, with these guys, once you've chosen the wood, and Rondon always would go with him and say, this, this, and this, because he knows what kind of trees are the best, it would take them 2 or 3 days. I mean, you've got 16 paddlers, so, you know, working in teams from, let's say, 8 in the morning till 10 o'clock at night, they made rapid progress. And they had to do that multiple times, build new canoes.
Well, Candido Rondon lived a long life. He died at the age of 93, I believe, in 1958. And at that time, he was a hero of Brazil. Among his accomplishments is that he was nominated for a Nobel Peace Prize.
Three times
for his work with indigenous tribes. How is he regarded in Brazil today, and what is his legacy?
His legacy is enormous and alive. He's a national hero. He's the only Brazilian who has a state named for him.
Rondônia,
absolutely. And his philosophy of nonviolence and his philosophy of working with indigenous peoples and creating a national park system has become a political tool that defenders of the Amazon make use of even today. And during the 4 years of Bolsonaro, Rondon's legacy as a pacifist and as a scientist was repeatedly cited as another path that we could take instead of the one that Bolsonaro is offering. Now you've got Lula back.
And what is that path?
Pardon me?
Just to be clear what that path is that Bolsonaro was offering.
Well, I mean, he wanted instant development, opening the Amazon, letting mining companies and loggers and ranchers run roughshod over the area and not giving any more land to the Indians and forcibly integrating them into Brazilian society if necessary.
Whereas Rondon was stressing the importance of working with indigenous groups to preserve the land.
To preserve the land and letting them decide for themselves to what degree, if any, they wanted to have contact and integration with larger Brazilian society, mm-hmm. and respecting the choices they made.
And it's not just a humanist approach. It is actually more practical.
It is.
To work with the people of the land to preserve the land.
Yes. I mean, it would seem to be obvious, right? But not to some.
Larry Roeder is a journalist. He's a former South American bureau chief based in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil, for the New York Times from 1999 to 2007. And he is the author of Into the Amazon, The Life of Candido Rondon, Trailblazing Explorer, Scientist, Statesman, and Conservationist. Larry, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Well, as we come to the big picture perspective of this episode, Cynthia, I'm going to throw a big picture question at you. What does saving the Amazon mean?
The biggest thing to remember is how many things it means. It means, I think, both specific sets of multinational agreements aimed at protecting the forests, which is the first thing that we think of, because of the forest's profound importance to the climate of the planet. It also means understanding how much human life exists in the Amazon and will continue to exist, and how complicated it is going to be to keep that life healthy and strong while doing the larger work.
So the idea is you can't take humans out of the equation.
Absolutely not. And I think it also means making some very large and difficult economic and political decisions about what we will prioritize, because many of the giant destructive decisions of the Amazon have been made because taking these resources out is very profitable for many countries and many private companies. And these companies and countries are providing things that people want and perhaps need, but you can't talk about, quote, saving the Amazon, unquote, until you start really looking at some of the economic models that have made taking these resources out so profitable.
Now, if it isn't evident by the end of this episode, what is at stake when we consider the peril that the Amazon is facing?
We lose the world's largest rainforest. We lose the world's largest single collection of species and plants and trees. We lose 14,000 years of history. But I think it's also what we bring, which is we bring a pernicious ripple effect onto the climate of the entire planet. Many of us have heard the expression, the Amazon is the lungs of the world. As I said before, it's so much more complicated and even more important than that. It is the nursery of the world, if you want. And what is lost if you kill the world's nursery and the world's single most productive source of biodiversity in plants and animals? This is a question for scientists who study this all the time. And the main thing I came away with is the enormity of the question itself.
Cynthia Gorney is a contributing writer to National Geographic magazine and the former Washington Post reporter and its South American bureau chief. She is also a professor emerita at the Graduate School of Journalism at the University of California at Berkeley. Cynthia, thank you so much for joining us on what is my first, but for you, another trip through the Amazon.
Thank you very much, Molly.
That's it for Sprouts. You've been listening to Amazing Amazonia, an episode from Big Picture Science. Special thanks to our guests, Cynthia Gorney and Larry Roeder. Our contributors this week were host Molly Bentley, production assistants Brian Edwards and Shannon Rose Geary, with further production, mixing, and editing by me, Gary Niederhoff. The Sprouts theme music is Torpedoes on Tuesday by Poison Control Center. Sprouts is a weekly program produced in collaboration with community radio stations and independent producers across the globe. The program is coordinated and distributed by Pacifica Radio. If you or someone at your station has a radio production that you wish to showcase nationally on Sprouts, contact our